This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I fear that it's going to hurt the country long-term economically because coal is expensive. And going forward, Indonesian consumers are going to be paying more for electricity than people in neighboring countries. And they're going to be dealing with air pollution, and they're going to be dealing with all these other environmental impacts. It's not a good long-term plan at all.
We often associate coal consumption with China and India, those countries that have indeed invested heavily into the harmful fuel. But flying under the radar is Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous country, which in the past two decades has become one of the world's leading exporters and consumers of coal. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to global journalist Nitin Koka, who's written a series of pieces for MangaBay.com about Indonesia's alarming headfirst dive into the coal industry. We discuss the high-level corruption that allowed coal to take off in Indonesia, examine the lax regulatory standards that imperil workers while allowing the country to keep export prices low, and learn about the environmental degradation that the Indonesian coal boom is causing. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by global journalist Nitin Koka. Nitin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Oh, great. Great to be here.
So you have a few pieces in Manga Bay that are quite interesting that I wanted to discuss with you about Indonesia and its coal industry. I was kind of surprised that Indonesia has flung itself with such force into coal, which so many of us think of as just a dying fuel. Why don't you first kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how this started? How did Indonesia kind of decide to go to what you call fossil fuel's final frontier?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I think Indonesia has always been, I guess, since independence and even before it got independence from the Dutch in the 1940s and 50s, like always a resource export country. And, you know, previous waves of exports were focused on like timber, spices, palm oil in the 90s. And then I guess around the turn of the century, Indonesia really started ramping up its production of coal. Basically, it went from being like almost a non-player in global exports to being last year the number one exporter of thermal coal. And it's been driven by the massive surge in demand in coal power generation in China, India, and Indonesia being geographically close to those countries being a key, having easy access compared to the United States or South Africa. And the fact that the lax environmental controls, lax environmental standards in many of the regions that produce coal meant that Indonesian coal could be a lot cheaper than other countries that wanted to export it. So it created a situation today where Indonesia, you know, it's one of the number one or number two export. And in a time where COVID-19 has created like an economic turmoil, the country is really trying to maintain its standing and maintain the kind of the presence of coal, even as kind of the headwinds are getting stronger and stronger around the world.
Where are things in the Indonesian government? It's no longer a dictatorship, but there's a lot of corruption, and it manifests itself in some pretty head-scratching decisions like this, doesn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, it's true. Indonesia is not a dictatorship. So the Suharto dictatorship, the Suharto regime fell in 1998, 1999, after more than three decades. But Indonesia never had this kind of big sweep and getting rid of all the people from the dictatorial era to today. So you have a lot of the same military generals and rulers and same oligarchs that have stayed in power despite this transition to democracy. And I think that's been one of the key factors. So a lot of the people that control the different ministries, a lot of the richest people in the country, they're people who made their wealth during the Suharto era. And coal is very, very closely connected. The person who ran for president against current President Joko Widodo, his opponent Prabowo Subianto, has significant holdings in coal. Another former presidential candidate is also coal wealth. several key ministers in the current president's cabinet have a lot of holdings in coal, or a lot of interest in coal, as do many members of parliament. So there's a lot of oligarchical entrenchment in the Indonesian government, despite this transition. I don't think the transition to democracy really meant a transition away from oligarchy and a lot of the crony business dealings that Indonesia has seen for several decades now.
And in an archipelago like Indonesia, it's so fragmented from island to island. We've had other journalists who've contributed to Mangga Bay writing about some of the feel-good stories in terms of conservation in the country. And so that's one of the reasons I was surprised to read your expose on the Indonesian coal industry, because I think of Indonesia, I like to think of it on a positive trajectory, like it's starting to realize that it can't destroy its rainforests forever, and that there is some kind of an important environmental movement in the country as well. Does that environmental movement stand a chance against big coal in Indonesia?
Yeah, I think we often forget like how big Indonesia is. It's the fourth biggest country in the world. It's 280 million people, 10,000 islands. So just like in the United States, you can have states like West Virginia and Wyoming, you know, really pushing coal, and you can have states like California or, you know, Washington going 100% clean energy. So you can have those two things happening in Indonesia as well. I think the challenge, like, I think in several of the major big islands, such as Java, which is more than half the population, includes the capital Jakarta, you're seeing significant amounts of coal-fired power plant development. And I think in Sumatra and Kalimantan on Borneo, in the Indonesian side of Borneo, is where you're seeing a lot of the mining take place, and you're seeing a lot of environmental destruction there. But one thing that does give me hope that I did find when I was doing the reporting for these projects is that a lot of these smaller coal-fired power plant developments on outlying islands in Indonesia, on smaller plants, less than 100 megawatts, 10 megawatts, apparently are being canceled, and there seems to be some shift in those regions towards using geothermal or solar or tidal, even, in one project. So I'm really interested to see, like, I think there is some hope if the trends we're seeing on smaller islands with less people where renewables make a lot more financial sense, if that can kind of impact what's happening on the larger islands where you really have this entrenchment of coal mining and coal electricity generation. So these two things are happening at the same time. Unfortunately, the power in Indonesia definitely lies in, even though it's a geographically diverse country or geographically dispersed country, it's very centralized politically, and the power is still in the hands of a few. And those few in Jakarta and in the upper, you know, business echelons are really promoting and pushing for government regulations to favor coal. And that's a big problem.
What percentage of Indonesia's coal is domestically consumed, and how much of it is exported? Do you know that offhand?
Yeah, I don't know the exact figures, but I believe it's 20% of Indonesian coal that's consumed domestically, and about 80% that's exported. And I think the key export markets are China, India, and then other Southeast Asian nations. Oh no, China, India, Japan, South Korea, and then Southeast Asian nations at a smaller percentage. And the government has plans to increase domestic consumption quite significantly in the coming decade. One of them is through what I mentioned.
I was surprised to see that Indonesia is actually building coal-fired plants fairly rapidly.
Yeah, I think at this current moment, Indonesia has more than 10,000 megawatts either currently at various stages of construction or planned. So it's one of the largest coal electricity pipelines anywhere in the world. And it's coming at the same time you're seeing neighboring countries like Vietnam, Bangladesh, and India really shift and kind of clamp down on their existing plans. Indonesia is still moving forward quite a bit. So it is an outlier in that sense, very much in the developing world.
And it was interesting to read that the Japanese banks have been kind of the traditional financiers of coal-fired plants in Southeast Asia, along with South Korean financial institutions, but they're starting to look a little bit more closely before throwing money at financing coal in countries like Indonesia. How do you think that may impact Indonesia's plans for expansion in this industry?
Yeah, so that's going to be really something worth watching. So last year, several financial institutions in Japan and South Korea both announced that they're no longer going to be funding coal-fired power plants going forward. One of the problems is that that doesn't impact existing plans. So any plants that already have financial commitments from Japan or South Korean banks are not affected. And that's unfortunately like most of the 10,000 megawatts I mentioned is already financed. So it doesn't have an immediate impact and doesn't have a short-term impact, but it's definitely going to have, I think, a longer-term impact. It's just uncertain what that impact will be. You know, I think people are still waiting to see how those commitments actually play out. And I think around the world, we've always seen, you know, commitments made by banks can often sound good, but they're not necessarily good when you actually look at like the impacts on the ground. And then China is kind of has been a holdout. So China actually, I believe, finances more coal-fired power plants in Indonesia than Japan or South Korea. So if China continues doing that, then it might negate the impact of those other two countries' moves.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to global journalist Nithin Koka. He has a piece in Manga Bay about coal in Indonesia. So, Nithin, the Indonesian population must not be thrilled about air quality. Just looking at purpleair.com, I see just in Sumatra, there's a lot of red and yellow and orange monitors showing very poor air quality. What is the Indonesian government plan on doing as it's choking its population under the coal-fired plant emissions?
Yeah, so that's something really, I think it's super interesting. Like the main grassroots opposition that I've seen to a lot of the coal-fired power plants, but also like growing in cities like Jakarta, which is becoming one of the most polluted cities in the world in terms of air quality, regularly in the top 10 most polluted cities in the world now. I think 1 or 2 years ago, like there was a citizens lawsuit filed in Jakarta that directly said the president is failing to protect the public health of Jakarta citizens. And I thought that that kind of like grassroots opposition, that could put a lot of pressure on the coal industry and then on the Indonesian government in a way that climate concerns, for example, may not, because public health and air pollution are kind of things that Indonesians will experience daily. So far, I don't think the government has responded yet. There are, I think, in the process of updating the coal emission standards, and it's going to be interesting if those emission standards are improved. Right now, they're very weak. Far weaker than the United States or Europe or China or India. So they don't require these coal-fired power facilities to use very even kind of, you know, the simplest modern technologies. Not even considering like the expensive kind of high emissions reductions technologies. So I think the air pollution concerns, I think they're going to keep on growing. I think people are becoming more aware that of the connection between coal-fired power and air quality in urban areas and in across Indonesia, and I think it's going to be more and more difficult for the government to ignore those concerns going forward. So it'll be interesting to see how they respond and if those actually do affect future coal plants.
As the cost-benefit analysis shifts and renewables keep dropping in price, it's going to be pretty hard for any government to push for dirty energy, when there's so much upside to trying to shift one's economy to a clean energy economy in terms of jobs, air quality, and ultimately the cost of electricity. What would be the most likely path for an Indonesia to start embracing the green energy future more effectively?
Yeah, Unfortunately, at this moment, the government has made it just very, very difficult, especially in the densely populated islands like Java and Sumatra, for clean energy to really take off, because they've just given so many benefits to the coal industry. Coal-fired power plants in Indonesia, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but they basically get a guaranteed rate for 10 or 20 years if they come online. And even if Indonesian consumers don't need electricity or there's a cheaper alternative, the government still has to pay those plants for operating. So you're basically giving like a subsidy or guaranteed income to coal-fired power plants. They have access to now a recent legislation passed last year that promotes other uses of coal, reduces the royalties that downstream consumption. So if the coal is consumed domestically, they don't have to pay as much tax. So that gives an unfair advantage to coal that makes it difficult for clean energy to compete. So the playing field is very, very uneven right now in Indonesia. For clean energy, it's really, really difficult to compete when you're competing against a heavily subsidized and heavily promoted coal. Where I do see some hope is, I mentioned earlier, in some of the outer islands. So in islands outside of Java and Sumatra and Borneo, where there's lower populations, where it doesn't make as much sense to build a coal-fired power plant, and where you're starting to see more renewable energy development. And these are places that are also quite often right now don't have access to reliable electricity. So I do think hopefully, as clean energy gets some uptake in those regions, hopefully the financial situation will improve and there'll be more investment, and then that could hopefully kind of shift and start coming into larger cities. But right now, there's very little. Indonesia has very paltry renewable energy targets for 2025 and 2030, and they're not in line even to meet those very low targets, because there's just been so much government promotion and support for coal. So it's not a good situation right now for the country, and I'd fear that it's going to hurt the country long term economically, because like you said, coal is expensive. And going forward, Indonesian consumers are going to be paying more for electricity than people in neighboring countries, and they're going to be dealing with air pollution, and they're going to be dealing with all these other environmental impacts. It's not a good long-term plan at all.
When you think of developing countries and the resource curse, it's usually oil, which has a pretty significant margin, but coal margins are next to nothing. And to quote your piece, you say the International Energy Agency, the IEA, expects global coal consumption to decline by 8% this year, the largest drop since 1945. So this is a dying industry by any measure, and yet here's this government just going full bore into it.
I think it really shows kind of the unfortunate kind of level of corruption and kind of how much coal interests are embedded in Jakarta. So they're passing laws and regulations that benefit their families and their companies. They're not really thinking about what benefits most Indonesians. And that's a shame, and I think it's a failure of a system that is democratic in some ways but isn't really representing people very well. But Indonesia has a very active civil society. There are a lot of groups challenging, the promotion of coal and challenging coal plants across the country. So there is hope also from I think growing awareness of people and growing understanding of climate and environmental impacts and the kind of just the whole cost to the huge cost to tropical forests and water and air of kind of over depending on coal.
So let's turn to the mining side of the coal equation, Nathan. Last September, Indonesia's parliament passed an industry-supported mining and mineral law, which kind of ignores a lot of environmental and social concerns. Can you give us more of an idea of the risk that these miners are taking, and how does their extraction processes, how do they differ from, let's say, in Wyoming, where there's a lot of easy coal to be had?
Yeah, so I've only been out to at least one of the coal mining regions once in East Kalimantan and Eastern Borneo. And yeah, it was quite stark what I saw there. Open mines right alongside villages, streams running through coal mines, entering people's farms, and that was the only source of water they had. And then just leaving these pits, these deep pits that would fill up with water, just not cleaning up after themselves. And then just transporting coal on these open barges along the river, just open gigantic coal barges, and all this coal dust just flying off. I remember going along the beach and finding pieces of coal on the beach because so much coal had just drifted away. So it's just, there's very, very lax environmental regulations. There's almost no enforcement of even existing environmental laws. And the mineral and mining law, the regulation kind of update that was passed last year, doesn't address any of those concerns about cleanup, and it kind of doesn't address kind of the issue, kind of the calls of local communities to ensure that miners like rehabilitate the land as they're supposed to, but instead kind of extends these mining permits so that companies have longer time to hold on to the land, and also kind of expands kind of the permissions for mining activities in river and seabeds, which is deeply concerning, especially as there's a lot of push by the mining industry to do like deep sea mining, and it's very concerning. And it was passed in a very, very rushed manner. It did not really incorporate local or civil society concerns. A lot of people felt that it was almost an anti-democratic process.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to journalist Nithin Koka. The poorest and most underdeveloped parts of the country are exposed to this mining. The local communities, though, aren't really benefiting much from this in terms of long-term job security, I imagine, forgetting about the haphazard environmental regulations, which seem to put them in peril health-wise.
Yeah, that's something I really want to understand better. So I did notice when I was visiting these regions that locals were not being hired by the mines. They're bringing in migrants from different parts of Indonesia to work there, which is a common practice in the palm oil industry or in other industries as well, where you rely on imported labor that lives on the plantation or lives on the mine and can be more easily controlled.
In like slave-like conditions, right? Fishing industry too in Indonesia. Some of these islands off of Thailand and Indonesia, we've spoken to journalists who've uncovered these people who've worked in shrimping and fishing industry for decades without a passport and essentially captives, prisoners on these islands working in horrible conditions for 18 hours a day. And I imagine being a migrant worker in a distant part of Indonesia isn't a cakewalk either.
Yeah, I imagine, like, I would not be surprised if you see some of the same issues in coal mining industry, but I haven't had a chance to go out there and I haven't seen that much reporting on kind of the labor side. I did see like a recent, at least someone sent me like a recent study that said like the number of jobs directly connected to coal mining is actually a lot lower than what the government projects and actually doesn't have that big of an impact on jobs.
Similar to the United States, where I think there's only like 50,000 coal mining jobs.
Right. So I think the local economic impacts, I think, are not, like, I don't think local communities in general, there probably are exceptions, but in general, I think they're not really benefiting from proximity, and probably more likely they're suffering, especially if they're, you know, indigenous communities or farmers, because they're seeing the water and other kind of the natural habitat they depend on being you know, degraded by these mines. So it's not quite clear what entirely the impacts are, but I imagine they're not as positive as the industry makes it out to be.
And what did Indonesia do for its electricity before this big investment into coal?
I'm not entirely sure. I imagine a lot of it was biomass. That's my guess. And probably a lot of Indonesians prior to 1990 were living off-grid or kind of relying on wood or kerosene much more.
So like large island-wide power plants were not ubiquitous.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the grid was like in Java at that time or in the more densely populated regions. Yeah, certainly there's been a big increase in kind of electricity demand due to kind of Indonesia's economic development and industrialization. And so demand was probably also a lot less back then.
And then you write about how we've heard about the promise of clean coal and coal gasification for many years now, and the industry in Indonesia is parroting that as well. Can you give us some insight into how that space is evolving?
Right. So I think this is it's connected to Indonesia's kind of the government's goal to increase domestic consumption. So there's only so much they can do with coal-fired generation. So gasification, which is the process of turning coal into a liquid fuel that can be used in chemical plants or, kind of replace liquid natural gas, which Indonesia primarily imports. So there's a big push to expand gasification in Indonesia. This really surprised me because I remember that in the United States, under the Bush administration, I was working for Sierra Club, an environmental NGO at the time. There was a big push to do the same thing domestically in the U.S., and it failed. Partly because the cost was just so high, and partly because we saw a fracking boom, which has this whole other set of environmental issues that made natural gas a lot cheaper, and coal just didn't make sense. To see Indonesia kind of reviving an idea that failed in America 15 years ago, that's immensely costly, is going to require huge amounts of government spending, and has very little like tangible benefits except to the coal industry. Was really surprising, but they do seem to be, really pushing forward. I saw that one of the companies based in Pennsylvania that was behind the gasification push in the U.S. is investing in a huge facility in Indonesia. So there is, I think the American coal industry, has been down and out for a while. They do see like hope in the fact that countries like Indonesia are kind of going forward with plans that they fail to kind of push domestically in the United States. And I think they want to, I think they still have a dream of exporting coal to Asia, which I think is a very, very unrealistic dream, even if all these plans go forward in Indonesia, because there just isn't going to be that much demand for coal, no matter what.
Well, it's a terrific series that you continue to contribute to on mangabay.com. We'll link to it via Sea Change Radio. Nithin Koka, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lettuce, The Police, and John Mooney.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.